Welcome back to Leveraging Leadership, where we unpack the art of business leadership. I'm your host, Emily Sander, Chief of Staff turned Executive Leadership Coach. And Leveraging Leadership is all about finding your points of greatest influence and leveraging them to better serve those around you. And today we are joined by Jim. Jim, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So first of all, I got to say, I've used the analogy of air traffic controller as a way to explain what a chief of staff is. And you have actually been an air traffic controller in the Marines, I believe. So my first question is, how good of an analogy is that to a chief of staff?
I love that analogy. I think it fits very nicely. Air traffic controller as a profession is all about safe and expeditious travel of aircraft. You want to keep everyone safe and headed in the right direction. And I think that for a chief of staff, that's matching very nicely what you want to do for your company, keeping everyone in the same direction, all rowing in the same direction, trying to get the job done safe and expeditiously as possible. So a very, very astute use of the analogy.
And then you're also coordinating a whole bunch of different groups, right? So the airlines, I guess, and commercial flights, but the different flight patterns and different aircraft coming in and the ground crew and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of pieces of individuals trying to get their job done all at once, and it's your job to make sure that they can do that. Give them the guidance and the overview to be able to make sure that they're not intercepting each other dangerously. And it's also one of the jobs that if you do it right, no one notices, but if you do it wrong, everybody notices. And I feel like chief of staff, similarly, if you're in the background and you're doing your job correctly, people don't even know you're there. But when you're missing or you're not doing it correctly, it's pretty evident that there's a problem.
They're not intercepting each other dangerously. Ooh, yes, that's got some serious ramifications in a real air traffic control situation. But it also translates to business when two executives or two departments are just clashing or kind of doing the same thing but not knowing it. So that's a good analogy. And I'm going to try one more expansion on the analogy. Is air traffic controller behind the scenes to a pilot? So the pilot is flying the plane and they're going out on different missions and people know who the pilot is, but they couldn't tell you who the head of air traffic control is.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. Most folks, whether they be commercial retail flyers or when an average person conjures up an image of what air travel and air traffic is like, they rarely think about the guy sitting in the radar room or the gal standing in the tower who's controlling all those aircrafts. They're thinking about the more sexy, appealing jobs who, you know, flying the aircraft, dropping the bombs, fueling the aircraft, all the cool things that are, you know, tend to be better shown on TV and movies. Air traffic control just is all about doing it right so that no one notices that you're doing it.
Yeah, when we think of pilots and kind of airplanes, we're thinking Maverick, right? Like Top Gun, who's my wingman type of thing.
Right. But right, not the guy dumping coffee on himself.
But yeah, we need those people. So yes, for sure.
Yeah, so, no, it was a great adventure to do that. So I'm very thankful for my background. So it absolutely gave me a lot of interesting stories to tell and good exposure to a lot of different operations.
Yeah. And I think one of the things you've mentioned about being chief of staff is you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And you're pretty much throwing yourself into new things every day. And I'm wondering, you know, given your military background, did that training help you prepare for this? Were you always one to kind of step out into the unknown? Or how did you hone that craft of being comfortable being uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think that being an officer in the Marine Corps definitely did prepare me to get the job done kind of no matter what it took. And whether that's physical discomfort or long hours or being away from your family, that was something that you accepted as kind of being part of the job. I was sent to schools where I would take classes and get qualified to do something that I had no background in and no personal interest in, but it needed to be done. And I think that that translates well to the chief of staff role. And most times in business, you need to be able to throw yourself into something that maybe isn't your specialty, maybe isn't your strength, maybe isn't something you even care about, but it needs to be done. And frankly, chief of staff is a great role because it straddles so many boundaries and you're able to be the one to handle all the things that don't fit neatly into other people's plates, or maybe straddle a few plates and no one's really sure who should own it. And, you know, chief of staff's kind of an executive at large. You have a loosely defined term of what you're supposed to be taking care of. And working at a startup, things happen all the time. New ideas pop up, new problems pop up, and somebody needs to tackle them and take them down. And I think that as a chief of staff, you need to take some pride and get excited about the fact that you can be the one to do that without having to be the expert in it, or without having to be the one that's the named boss and getting the applause for having done it.
And when you've been in situations where you're not the subject matter expert, maybe someone else has deeper technical knowledge, but yet you're involved in this, you're spearheading something, you have to make decisions about it. How do you approach that with team members who are like, might be looking down on you saying, why is Jim asking me these questions?
I mean, I think you got to come from a real sense of humility, and everyone, I assume that everyone on your team is going in the same direction. And if not, you have some human resources problems. But frankly, if you've got the right team and the right people trying to all get the job done, they're glad that someone's owning the process. So it tends to be more of a sense of relief that, oh, thank goodness someone's going to own this rather than I have to own it. And then I think that also that sense of humility personally of understanding that you may not have the answer, you may not be able to figure it out, you may not gain the kind of expertise and growth that you will be an expert by the end of the project. But if you can piece together a kind of a 70% solution now, it's better than having the 100% solution when it's too late. And that's something that I learned in the military, and again, comes up in business all the time. People need a plan, they need action, and then you need to be responsive and reflexive to the facts on the ground or the situation at hand, rather than trying to adhere to a perfect plan that has to be perfect and has to be remained adhered to at all times. So I think humility, flexibility, and the understanding what balls that you're juggling are glass and what balls are rubber. And you can drop the rubber balls, but you can't drop the glass balls. And that takes a deep understanding of what the real impacts of your actions are. And sometimes you need to make those mistakes and learn from them in order to really figure out what's important and what needs to be handled immediately versus what can be put off versus what can get dropped completely.
Oh my gosh, I love that. So rubber balls and glass balls, because chiefs of staff are juggling things all the time, perpetually. And at certain points, you have to let stuff drop. And sometimes it's your job to let stuff drop so you can focus on other things, but you have to know which ones. So which ones bounce up off the floor and which ones shatter and break forever.
Forever, yeah. Mistakes you can't take back. Yeah, you want to avoid that.
Oh, wow. I like that a lot. Okay. And then you mentioned making decisions, and I've been in positions where there is no obvious answer. If there was an obvious answer, people would have been all over it. But everyone's kind of sitting there looking around, seeing who's going to make a decision. And I don't know the quote unquote right answer, but even coming up with, hey, here's a next step. Here's like some action we can take, because people have this anxiety or just this energy kind of humming there. And if you give them a channel to put it to and to take a next action step, sometimes that helps people. Like you said, the plan might need to change, or you might need to adapt or be flexible. But I found like just giving them something to do is often helpful. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree completely. The term I've heard is analysis paralysis, where you're trying to figure out what the exact right thing is to do and nobody has any action plan moving forward. So sometimes just taking that first step is exactly the crack that you need to get a toehold to go into the next bigger step. I've also found that sometimes I'll open my mouth, I'll give an idea, and someone who's a lot smarter than me will say, that's not going to work. It's a terrible idea. But even doing that allows them to start discounting options or closing doors and realizing where the paths of opportunity are. And that's really like maintaining that the conversation moves forward, that an action plan gets created, that people have a space to be able to move into their next motion. That's going to be key to getting things done. And everything about being a chief of staff is all about getting things done. And it's all about, how do you make it so a plan turns into action, turns into a repeatable process? And sometimes that means making mistakes. Sometimes that means giving an idea that could be simple to you, but someone else hasn't thought of. And sometimes that means stepping back and letting other people have an ownership point, and you just provide support as they try to create their own magic. And I found that letting people who are experts make decisions tends to lead to a better outcome, but they may not know how to make those decisions happen in reality. And that's where I can fill in some of the more logistical or operational technicalities that I can provide, whether it be administrative work or ensuring that there's budget or there's capacity or there's timing to making their plan come to life.
And I'm wondering too, because you seem similar to me, you are in a kind of startup or smaller environment, relatively small to medium business, and you seem very action-oriented and driven and let's make this happen. And I'm wondering, there are times as chief of staff when your job is to zip it and your job right. is to let others talk or even let the discussion unfold. And I've had times where I'm like, I know the answer. Like, I know what we need to do, but it's my job to actually hold that space and let a discussion happen. Sometimes we end up going with the solution that I originally had in mind. Other times they come to a better conclusion. I'm like, oh, just kidding. That's what we should do. So I'm just wondering, how you have you run into that? How do you navigate that? What's your advice there?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real, I feel like action-oriented people, folks that want to get the job done and do it right and do it quickly, there might be a instinct to jump in and give the answer. And my wife will tell me I do that in our marriage. I do that at work. It's something that I've had to learn to pull myself back and let the situation and let the group dynamics flow and congeal so that they may come up with the same answer I had 2 hours ago. But that 2 hour process of them deciding and talking builds out their dynamics and builds out their relationships and allows them to succeed in ways that if I had just given the answer, we would have missed out on the opportunity. There's, you know, a time when I was an officer and I had enlisted Marines and I wanted them to solve a problem. Me micromanaging them and telling them how to solve a problem took away the opportunity for them to figure it out. It took away the pride of them figuring it out, took away the fit rep bullet of them being able to say, I figured it out, took away the story, the beer at the end of the day. Just giving the answer didn't help anybody. It just got things done. And if it's not a life or death situation or mission critical, give yourself and your team the time to be able to do that. Let them make mistakes. Let them figure it out. And as a chief of staff, you know, I run the meetings and strategic discussions so that department heads and subject matter experts can get together and discuss. And the value is the fact that I'm holding that space for them and I'm allowing them to be able to have the time that they've dedicated to do this the right way. And sometimes magic happens and you didn't see it coming. Your exact situation, you know, the example you gave of they come up with a better answer that you would have never known. And I think ultimately it comes back to humility of understanding that while you may have an answer that works, it's worth it to let the team come up with an answer that works for them and in their own way and in their own manner. And ultimately, you know, I am not an engineer, so I understand that there are aspects of engineering or of marketing or of sales or of all these business areas that I am not an expert in that are going to have nuances that I don't understand and I'm never going to see them coming. So letting them be able to figure it out, voice their opinion, feel that pride, understand that they created something better is an intangible that I think is worth investing in.
And I think it's like you said, it's situational, right? So if my worst case scenario is far different than a Marine worst case scenario, but if the servers are down and all of our client websites are down, I'm going to be much more directive and much more let's go. And if it's a brainstorming session where we're offsite and we're talking about different ideas and big picture stuff, I'm going to have a lot more latitude and space in that conversation. So I think it is figuring out where you're at with that. But I do understand. I learned when you're with engineers and technologists and you're not an engineer or technologist to not say, well, this should be easy. Why don't we just do this, this, and this? Because that's the way to burn some bridges.
You just doomed yourself to hours of work by saying it's easy and simple and it'll be done quickly. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's a button. You should be able to change like, no. Okay. Help me understand the options for the button. But yes. Awesome.
You bring up a great point. I think that taking advantage of opportunities to learn and letting people teach you is hugely valuable, not only for you personally and your professional development, but building that relationship with folks and in understanding how they approach problems. Because I think learning how they approach problems is going to help you help them solve problems long term. And exactly right with technologists and engineers, but also creatives and people that do things in maybe nonlinear ways or ways that seem like they don't make sense to me as a business or math-minded or however your brain works, letting them figure out their problem and explain to you how they figured out that problem is hugely valuable because you're going to be pulling these people together and trying to get them to work together. And you need to understand that if someone is quiet and thoughtful and someone processes their thoughts out loud and somebody wants to walk and talk and somebody wants to sit and think, and all those people need to mix together. You need to be able to facilitate it so that everyone can work at a level where they're comfortable and they're able to be productive and helpful and make that final solution where the business succeeds.
Yes. And I'm more on the introverted side. I mean, there's a little bit of introvert and extrovert in everyone, but in a team meeting, I'm actually not one to barge in and take over that conversation. I will if no one else is going to do it, but I would much rather sit there and observe and kind of see how people are taking it in and see the different ideas and think about it, maybe write some notes down and then come back to the group with something. Now, I've learned that sometimes I have to accelerate that process and do it very quickly on the fly, but there are people who will try to call on me to make sure everyone has a chance to participate. And I'm like, I'm not ready. I'm not done thinking yet. So it's knowing that about your different players or your different team members.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that most people's initiative and instincts are coming from a good place. They're trying to have everyone feel heard. They're trying to have everyone have a voice. But you're exactly right that some people don't want to participate because they need to mull it over, whereas some people, the act of speaking is how they think about the process. Yes. And, allowing for the quiet folks to have their time and space and the louder folks to understand that they need to give that time and space is all about people management. And it's much more of an art than a science. There's no particular right way to do it. It's I think as a chief of staff and as a leader in general, being able to sit back and learn that process and learn your people and learn the particularities of the situation is a lot more valuable than barging in and trying to fix everything right away, because your fix may bowl over someone else's great idea or make them feel disenfranchised or disconnected from the group. And similarly, there's tends to be a dynamic in a group that if you sit back and observe, you can see where the strengths and weaknesses are pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're busy talking and telling and fixing the problem, you may miss out on some of those cues. And those are really, really valuable long-term when you're trying to develop your team's personal and professional capabilities, as well as that dynamics of who works best together and who solves problems in certain ways.
Yes, yes. And I also love just going back to your creatives. So I was in charge of our corporate marketing for a period of time. And I remember I'm like, here's our goal. And let's reverse engineer into the milestones we need to hit by when. And we outline that with our graphic designers and all the folks. And I would get to our check-in meetings and they wouldn't have done what they were supposed to do in that week. And I'm like, wait, we were really clear. We had it on the share screen. We verbally confirmed it was due today. And the graphic designers gave me an answer like, well, I just wasn't in the creative headspace. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter because there's a deadline. But for them, they need to kind of ebb and flow and find it. And they eventually always would. It would come up with some fantastic stuff that I was like, how did that come out of your head? But it was very, very different than like a typical project plan with we're going to hit these deadlines and hit these marks or else we're falling behind. So that's another great call out from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's these variables in reality that people can't factor into a math equation, whether it be the creative headspace that someone needs to be in, or the chaos theory of just like things happen that you're not going to calculate, and you're not going to know it until it happens. And it might, some idle Tuesday, a bolt of lightning might strike. That's going to really change your plan. And you can't plan for that. You can't foresee it and say, oh, well, Tuesday will be the day that we have to change everything. You just have to be reactive to it. And I think understanding, like I said, that sense of humility of there's always something to learn. There's always someone else to ask a question to. There's always another voice that's worth pulling into the conversation. And then balancing that with that sense of proactivity of when things need to happen, they need to happen. And if I need to be the one making that decision, I'm okay doing that. Similarly, if someone else needs to make that decision and I need to sit back and support them, I'm okay doing that too. And it's really putting the group dynamic, the greater business goals, your objectives, the success of the team ahead of your ego or ahead of what you think should be happening or ahead of what your plan says this should happen. It's just, it's all such a requirement for flexibility. And like you started the conversation, just being comfortable, being uncomfortable, and knowing that there's going to be something that you can't control. There's going to be some anxiety that you can't put your arms around. There's going to be some aspect that just happens and you react to it as best you can.
And it's almost like Don't let that surprise you. I mean, the change is only a constant. There's that saying, but people often are like, I'm so surprised that things happen unexpectedly. I'm like, why? They always do. They never go to plan. Yeah.
Exactly. So. Stuff breaks all the time. People get sick. Decisions don't work out. External factors affect you, and it's just reality. And I think that, you know, if you can keep a clear head and stay calm, that's contagious for people. Whereas if you start letting the situation dictate your mindset, that's going to be contagious for people too. And if you can set the example of how you want others to react to things, they will follow in tow.
Yes, I was talking to my young niece recently, and we were discussing how you are not your feelings and you are not your thoughts, which is, you know, a tough concept to kind of grasp when you're a kid. But I feel like adults sometimes need to be reminded of that too. And I need to be reminded of that myself, where, you know, just because you're feeling this way, you can take different action. And so I think that's, as chief of staff, you know, sometimes in my brain, I was like, oh, expletive, oh, bleep, like this is horrible. But on my face, you know, the like, I came off as calm and had a lot of reserve and just cool, calm and collected. And inside I was terrified. But these things, you know, these things have to transpire like they will. One thing that you mentioned as a key project that you worked on as chief of staff was this event having to do with a farmhouse in the UK. So without saying more, can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, sure. So I work for Smart Car. We're a platform for car data. And as a requirement for our engineering, we need access to physical vehicles. So it's not just a digital problem, it's a physical problem, because as we send, say, a command for lock and unlock, we need to ensure that the car locks and unlocks. And what happens when you open a car door and then tell it to lock? How does the car react? What kind of errors get sent back? So there's all these nuances that require us to get physical access on vehicles. And it's not realistic that we buy every make, model, year of vehicle that we could possibly get our hands on. That's not realistic from a capital standpoint. But we needed to figure out how to do that. And specifically, we were looking at Europe and European vehicles, which, in case you didn't know, US connected car services tend to be different than European connected car services. And they don't always work the same. And it's a nuance that you have to figure out, not to mention there are brands in Europe that aren't available in the US. So we're trying to solve this problem. We're a remote company, at the time, we were all US based, primarily in California. How do we get our arms around this European car problem? And I attacked it head on. I said, you know, if we need cars, let's rent a bunch of cars. And said, okay, if you rent cars, how do you get the engineers there? I said, well, we fly them out and let's rent a house and we'll stick the cars at the house. Well, how are you going to stick this many cars at a house? Okay. So we, you know, you start to backwards plan, as you were mentioning, that backwards engineering. And we realized that a farmhouse not too far out of London with a big field could fit all the cars we needed. We got the permission of the homeowner to do this. He thought it was a great idea. We told the car rental companies, you know, we want to rent all these cars for this specific amount of time. This is what we're doing. They were great with it. Got the insurance arranged, got everybody's lined up. And wow. I planned out an international trip for four engineers and myself to fly to London, drive 45 minutes north. 17 cars were delivered to a farmhouse. And for 2 weeks, those engineers worked, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, bless their hearts. They worked really hard getting kind of every data point they could imagine off of these vehicles, trying to just suck as much value out as possible. And we ran into headaches that had to be solved. Like the farmhouse had a EV charging capability, but it was a standard type 1 charger that plugs in your normal outlet. And really having a level 2 charger, which is an integrated charger for alternating current, would have been better. So I figured out, you know, within a few days, I could have a electrician out installing a type 2 charger. And I talked to the homeowner and said, hey, would you mind if we invested, you know, a little bit of money into your house to make it nicer and you could have a type 2 charger? And he agreed and let that happen. So, you know, just handling the problems as they come up, solving them as they happen, being uncomfortable. You know, it was spider season, which I don't know if you knew that was a thing in England. So it was, you know, mid-fall and the engineers show up and the house has a lot of spiders in it. You know, them being uncomfortable and figuring it out, jet lag, dealing with people's travel schedules and being away from family. And we just, you know, you as a target pops up, you take it down. And you just keep planning and keep executing, keep planning until eventually all the cars got returned, all the engineers came home, and now we've been using that data to be able to build out new brand coverages for European brands.
Okay.
Yeah, huge investment, huge time. I'm very grateful and thankful that my executive team supported me and everybody gave me the green light, but I'm incredibly proud that it happened because taking it from theory in early July to execution by mid-August was a really quick timeline. It wasn't inexpensive. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't risk and opportunities for things to go wrong, but, you know, taking that step and making the plan and reiterating and talking to people, it was a great success and I'm really proud of it.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that story. That's whenever I hear like a farmhouse out in the UK, that's a good story to tell. And on that, I'm wondering, so it seems like the outcome from that was a rousing success, but I'm wondering going into that, did you and your executives talk about, hey, here's the ROI, here's the potential ROI we want to be able to get. It is expensive. It is time consuming, but this is what we think we can get from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we used a couple of factors that we thought about. One was number of brands or number of cars that we could actually get access to. If it was below a certain number, we decided this wasn't worth our time. And cost was another factor of it. If it was going to spin out of control and have exorbitant costs that we weren't expecting, we were going to have to nix that. And then last, particularities of working in an international situation with understanding their insurance program and their car requirements and their hiring and all of the nuances there were potential pitfalls that, you know, if we, like, the engineers couldn't drive the cars on public roads. It was something that we took off the table to begin with, because one, there's a licensing issue with US to UK. We didn't want to have to deal with that. Two, the insurance issue from US to UK. We didn't want to have to deal with that. And then three, obviously they drive on one side of the road, we drive on the other.
Yes.
You know, the engineers didn't have experience doing that. Roundabouts can be treacherous. It wasn't worth the risk for us. So the field that we had was big enough that they could stay on private land and be able to drive the cars around essentially a tenth of a mile in a big loop. That worked out fine for us. And if they needed to go anywhere or get anything delivered, Uber, Lyft, taxis, you know, there was a lot of opportunity for other ways to be able to fill that need. So we were trying to create kind of red lines of, if the project looks like this, we can't do it. It doesn't make sense. And I aimed the project to exceed those in every way I possibly could. I got more cars than we needed. We got more access than we needed. We put more constraints and more side rails on it to be able to keep people safe and smart. And, you know, part of it also came down to trust. You're sending your people to another country with a lot of cars, you know, with a potential for an international incident or bad things happening. And you have to trust to a certain degree that your people are going to do the right thing. You give them the guidance and then you let them fly from the nest and hope that they do it right. And I think that goes back to hiring the right people and having the right team built, is that, you know, if you can't trust your people to execute correctly, they probably shouldn't be on your team. That's a red flag for the composition of who you're working with.
And I think especially for a startup, I mean, if you've got, I was on a startup with six people and then another one with 11. And I'm like, if you have, I don't know, like 10 people in the company and you hire one more, that's a large percentage versus once you get to a multinational corporation, hires are important there too. But in that startup environment that you were operating in, how involved were you in the recruiting process?
So the team that we pulled from was already established engineers. We worked with folks that first met the minimum requirements. Did they have a passport? Were they comfortable leaving the country? Did they have family requirements that would have totally made it a bad opportunity for them? So once we got our list set from there, I leaned on my engineering leads to understand kind of what skill sets do we need? And that's where it comes from. I'm not an engineer. I don't know who's going to have the expertise or be able to, you know, do the job that needs to be done. And then the caveat that the other side of that is we wanted to bring in maybe some folks that this could be a learning opportunity for them. Maybe they don't have the right skill set, but this could be something where they're sitting with a senior engineer and they're able to learn the process, you know, using that, because we're a remote company, using that in-person experience for them to be able to have some very, you know, drinking from a fire hose learning experience of understanding how it gets done the right way. And then once we built our team, I approached the folks and said, kind of, this is our goal. This is our mission. This is what we're going to be doing. This is how I'm laying it out. And then I tried to get their particularities and personal needs. You know, does anyone have any dietary restrictions? Anyone have any cultural or religious restrictions? Anybody have any timing restrictions? Is, you know, what can I do to prepare ahead of time to make this comfortable for you? What can I do ahead of time to make sure that everybody's taken care of? And it worked out well, I think, because everyone had a sense of adventure and wanting to get it done, wanting to make the company succeed. So I'm lucky. A good attitude and some ibuprofen and everybody turned out just fine.
Good attitude and ibuprofen, that'll solve a lot of problems for you. oh my goodness. And one of the things you mentioned that I think is key is chiefs of staff should be looking for opportunities to give their team members room to grow and room to shine. And if you have a learning opportunity where, hey, you know, we have the option to send, I don't know, Anna over here. We don't technically have to, but she would add something and it would be a great experience for her. And that would take her from, you know, this level to this level if she maximizes that. So I think opportunities like that, you should be on the lookout for them and create them when you can. But even if there's like, okay, we're doing this anyway, and you're on the fence about something, definitely send her because it's going to be a growth opportunity for her. So that was another great thing that you mentioned.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true that, you know, there's the fear that if you invest in your people and they leave, it's a lost investment. But there's the caveat that the other side of that of if you don't invest in your people and they stay, you have underdeveloped, underprepared workforce. And that's always the risk with people is that they're not going to be at the company. Not everybody's a lifer. But you need to be able to develop them because one, you're making them better for the company. Two, you're making them better for themselves. And three, you're going to build a sense of, you know, respect, connection, indebtedness because you help them get better. And people understand that when the company invests in them, it's a sense of trust, respect, value that you can carry forward.
I always say too, people like to be challenged. Like we have this weird thing in society, like kind of an undercurrent of, you know, make sure people are supportive and all these safe spaces. And like, yes, make sure it's like a safe, good, legal place to work. But people like to be pushed and challenged. And knowing that they've overcome something that they didn't think they can do grows you as a person and as a leader more than almost anything I can think of. And so doing that for someone is certainly benefits the company, but also benefits them personally. And I mean, I would make an argument benefits the world. So I think those opportunities are good ones to look for.
Yeah, I hugely agree with you. I think that's something that's undervalued of being able to push people and make and force them to grow. And growth is uncomfortable. Growth comes from discomfort. Growth comes from being outside of where you think you should be. And I'm with you that, you know, we should build supportive spaces and have safe spaces and things should be done the correct legal way and people should be heard and felt. But ultimately, it's development is going to come from a place of doing something you've never done before. Yeah. And that's always uncomfortable. And you get better when you're able to do that and feel a sense of, confidence, a sense of value in yourself and that growing esteem of, I can kind of do anything because I've handled hard things before. I've done harder things than what I'm doing right now. And that's going to make for a better company, a better team, a better world.
And I think as chief of staff, when you know that you can do that, when you're confident in, I don't know anything about this, but I can figure it out because I've done it so many times before, or this makes me nervous, or I feel afraid in this group because I don't know anything. I don't have the technical knowledge, but I've been here before and I know that I can add positive contribution. So yeah, that's so key. And I think that, people aren't, happiness isn't being comfortable and having all of your needs met. People always say, I want to be happy. And that's kind of what they go to. I think people want fulfillment and meaning. And how you get fulfillment and meaning is you overcome challenges and you grow as a person. And so I think there's, you know, sometimes you have to rest and sometimes you have to recoup and recharge. I totally get that. But overall, I think people who are on that trajectory of let me be challenged, let me overcome it, let me go to a new level, that's just where people light up.
Right. Yeah. I tend to agree with you. I think that you never know what someone's personal story is and what they've had to overcome and what their situation has dictated. And I try not to make the assumption that someone is comfortable and needs pushing if I don't know their full story. But I do know that giving someone the opportunity to grow giving someone the opportunity to learn more is always valuable. And if they decide not to take it, that's the way that happens. But it's being able to create situations where people can get better and do better and learn more. You'll see that they take advantage of that. And by and large, I think you're right. People want to achieve. They want to do better.
And as we wind down here, what is a piece of advice or just a tip or trick that you would have liked to have had when you first started as chief of staff?
One of the things I did early on that I think everybody should do is take time to learn the system before you try and change it, before you interject yourself into it. I think mistakes that I've made in the past have come from trying to fix a problem that may not be there, or perceive that I can improve a system without really understanding it or understanding the people. So taking the time to be able to just learn and absorb before you dive in and start to muddy the waters. I also think that as a chief of staff, coming in and saying, I don't know, coming in and saying, I don't have the answer, being willing to do the research and work hard and try and still fail is incredibly valuable. But, you know, nobody wants you to come in and fix everything and do it perfectly and have all the answers. They want you to come in and grow. They want you to come in and see a problem and fix a problem and have the attitude of, I'm going to push my efforts so that the company can do better, so that my team can feel supported, so my executive can feel supported. And it's okay to make mistakes. Embrace them, encourage them, because the mistake means you're trying. And as long as you're not living in a world of just making mistakes and then stopping, it's okay to keep going. You just keep pushing along.
And I love what you said, because I think people, they don't want someone with all of the answers. They want to know they have someone who can help the team get to a good answer. And I think that's what a chief of staff does. And that's what you were describing. So that's a great note to end it on. So Jim, thank you so much for stopping by Leveraging Leadership. It's been a blast talking to you. I have enjoyed our conversation, and you are welcome back anytime. But thank you for sharing all of the valuable insights.
Thank you. This was so much fun. It was really nice talking to you.
Sharing is caring. Send a link to this show to someone you think would enjoy it and tag Emily on LinkedIn. She'll give you a shout out on the next episode as a thank you for helping get the word out.